from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of the Indianapolis School of Ballet's spring concert featuring selections from Swan Lake.
I'll examine Typhoid Mary in a new production at the Phoenix Theater.
And just in time for the month of May, I'll meet an artist who specializes in large paintings of race cars. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. This spring, the Indianapolis School of Ballet will present From Swans to Splendor, which features selections from Swan Lake as well as other works. Travis DiNicola spoke with the ballet's director, Vicki Liris, about the production, as well as with Lori Ecker.
Vicki, Lori, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you both.
Thank you for having us.
You are very welcome. You are very welcome. I'm excited about this spring concert From Swans to Splendor, featuring Act Two of Swan Lake. And we're going to get into that in just a second. But before we do, let's talk about the School of Ballet. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yes, we are wrapping up our ninth year. It's been certainly an exciting journey. The school has grown to approximately 225 students over the past 9 years. We are hosting our summer intensive June 8th through July 3rd. Mm-hmm. I had a national audition tour this spring, which was quite successful in 10 cities. So it's a lot of growth. And along with our three programs, the Young Children's Program, ages 4 to 7, the pre-professional track, ages 8 through 18, and our adult program, we have two new initiatives this year, that being the Young Men's Full Scholarship Program for young boys.
This is pretty exciting. I think it's a really cool program to really encourage young men to get involved in ballet. Tell me more about this.
It is. We are so excited to grow this program and looking for young men ages 7, 8, and up to train with in classical ballet. We have right now roughly a dozen young men at our school.
How do you find these young men?
Well, from all different ways. I think the majority of the time these little boys are trekking along with their older sister or younger sister and waiting around, and they're bored, and then all of a sudden they get a little bit intrigued and hopefully smitten by this. Certainly that was the case with the legendary dancer Edward Villella.
Mm-hmm.
He used to tag along with his older sister.
And then finally started taking classes?
Right.
And then,
she quit and he became the most famous American ballet dancer. So that's one way. The other way that we feed young men into this program is through another initiative we started in the fall called Indie Ballet Classrooms. I'm truly excited about this outreach program. We completed the program at IPS 87 this past fall with our pilot program. And out of the 56 students that participated in this 10-week program, we selected 12 children on full scholarship to ISB to continue learning the art form.
So these are IPS students, and you're going in and you're doing classes? Are you also doing performances, or how does that work during the 10 weeks?
We our trained staff goes to the site, to the school, once a week, for depending on the individual school, for 9 to 10 weeks, for roughly 45 minutes a week, teaching them the basic vocabulary of ballet, and also two ballroom dances, just so they learn how to interact with one another. And in the completion of this program, they have a short performance of what they have accomplished that has been choreographed. This happened last December. They had a showcase for the children at IPS 87. And from those students, we selected the group that I'm referring to. So we have 10 ladies and 2 gentlemen in this program.
Oh, very cool. Now, had any of the students in these in the IPS program, have they taken dance before?
Never. Or? And chances are they never would, and they would not have the opportunity from various standpoints. Either they didn't know about anything about the art form or don't have the means financially. So we are bringing the art of classical ballet to the public schools.
But how old are those kids in the IPS program?
We are. We have been working with second and third graders, so roughly 8 to 9 years of age.
Yeah.
So that is certainly another way how we will continue to grow the program with young men.
That's awesome.
Right.
That's really cool.
And
there's plans to continue that program as well, right?
Absolutely. We are working with over 100 children in 3 different schools this semester, and it's kind of caught like wildfire for next year. So it's very exciting for us. And the children who truly show the potential, the aspiration, and the desire, and they have the work ethic, these children will continue to stay with us, and we will move them into the pre-professional track. And as long as we see the potential and the desire, they will be on full scholarship, including attire.
Wow, that's really great. Yeah, because I know that shoes can get pricey as well as dance clothes. And
everything,
stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for me, this is a special program. I was so fortunate to receive a full scholarship at the School of American Ballet my last 3 years of training. And had I not received that scholarship, I probably would have had to quit because could not afford it.
Yeah.
So I was given the gift of a career, truly, just by this scholarship. So you never know.
Well, I am looking forward to finding out in future years how this turns out and maybe finding that some of these young students from IPS turn out to be incredible professional ballet dancers. That would be awesome.
That would be truly awesome.
So let me just remind our listeners, Vicki, that the Indianapolis School of Ballet, you have your studios downtown in Indianapolis on Central Avenue, sort of at Central Michigan.
And we are actually 502 North Capitol Avenue.
Not Central, excuse me. That's what I meant to say. Capitol and in Michigan there. And then your performances are actually over at the Scottish Rite Cathedral on Meridian, which is just an incredible space to perform in, and that's where the spring concert is going to be, from Swans to Splendor. So tell me about the spring concert.
Yes, it is. It's a beautiful venue. I love the Scottish Rite, and it truly has become our second home. The performances are May 16th, Saturday, May 16th, and Sunday, May 17th at 3 p.m. both days. And it opens with the iconic Swan Lake Act 2. I love this ballet. It's the epitome of classical ballet. And it's very exciting because we have some 13-year-olds who are performing in now, very talented 13-year-olds. And it's for 18 swans, of course, the Huntsman and Odette and Siegfried. So it's a big, big production and beautiful costumes. Actually, the costumes are vintage costumes from Pennsylvania Ballet. And one of them has my name from 1978. It truly has my name in it. So it is... It's a beautiful opportunity for these dancers to experience Swan Lake.
And it's a challenging piece.
Extremely challenging to learn to move and with such finesse and precision, and to truly look like you're floating and your arms are just soft and as if you're flying through a jar of honey almost. So it's a major challenge for them, but this is part of their education. This is what prepares them for the real thing.
So the title of the show is From Swans to Splendor. What's the splendor?
The splendor is we are doing George Balanchine's False Fantasy, which is one of my favorite ballets. It's a jewel that Mr. Balanchine choreographed in 1967 for 4 ladies and a principal couple. Beautiful music of Mikhail Glinka. And then we have a contemporary piece by Roberta Wong titled We See things as we are.
Very cool. Well, Roberta, of course, used to dance with Dance Kaleidoscope.
Correct.
And is a great photographer, and I know still involved in teaching as well.
Yes, she teaches full-time for us, and she's a wonderful choreographer, so her ballet will be premiering, and really excited about that.
That's very cool.
Yes.
And now the dancers are primarily from the school in the pre-professional program.
Yes.
But there are other dancers that are involved in these pieces?
Yes. I have four students from Indiana University. They're four of my students.
Mm-hmm.
And Grace Phelps, of course, graduated from our school and is now at IU, and then two gentlemen. We have Colin Ellis and Andrew Copeland, and also a young lady, a freshman this year, also Maggie Andriani, who's performing with us. And Maggie will be actually premiering Saturday in Raymonda. We're also doing Raymonda Act 3, which is the wedding act. So it's a beautiful, beautiful, regal event, beautiful Hungarian dances and costumes.
So this is a real sampler, isn't it, of a variety of ballet?
It's a mixed repertoire program, mm-hmm. and there is definitely a lot of splendor.
Very cool. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a terrific program.
And yes, and two other very important guests. We have Betsy Boxberger, mm-hmm. also an IU grad and a graduate from Duke University. She's performing with us. She's a professional dancer. And then, of course, our very, very beloved Chris Lingner, who has danced with us for many, many years.
He's just a fantastic dancer,
yes,
a great young man.
And he's a professional dancer also with Cincinnati Ballet, so he will mm-hmm. be joining us also.
Nice. Nice. Very good. And again, those are on the 16th and 17th at Scottish Rites. Lori, for people who are interested in getting tickets or getting more information, or maybe they have kids that they would like to enroll in the Indianapolis School of Ballet, what should they do?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you can buy tickets online 24/7 at indieballet.org. You'll see a banner for the show, and you just click on that and you can purchase your tickets. If people want to purchase them over the phone or in person, we can do that from 4 to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday or on Saturdays. We're closed on Sunday, and this Sunday we have May We Dance, which is our all-school performance. But if they want to enroll, mm-hmm. by golly, they can just give us a call at 317-955-7525, and anyone can help them set up a trial class. Just call and ask for myself, Lori Ecker, or Victoria Lyris, and we can work that out for them.
And adults, too.
Yes. The adult open division classes are fantastic. You pay as you go. You enroll in each class as you go. You don't have to commit. You can mm-hmm. come whenever you can come is fine. They're just a drop-in class or an hour and a half, Tuesdays and Thursdays from 7 to 8:30 in the summer as well. We do suspend those when we're on our breaks in between, so you might want to call in and make sure that
sure.
you're, you know, not trying to come in when we're closed. So
mm-hmm.
those classes are $20 a piece. They have really grown in popularity over the last year, really grown. So that's exciting, and we have wonderful teachers. Victoria takes care of the intermediate class on Tuesday, and Colleen Ray teaches our beginning classes, and they're very popular classes now.
Excellent.
We love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful space, too.
It
your studios
is a beautiful
are gorgeous.
Space. Yeah, it's yeah. really. And now that we have all the new beautiful buildings cropping up around us, it's quite a buzzing, fun
Very
area
urban.
To be. Marsh is right across the street. Yay.
That's right, the new Marsh.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, one other thing that I want to mention is your big soiree, which is the fundraiser for the Indianapolis School of Ballet, and featuring some of the performances from Swans to Splendor, is also coming up on May 15th. And people can still get tickets for that as well, right?
Yes, certainly through this Friday and very early next week. The event is Friday the 15th. This particular gala is very important to us because it is our annual scholarship fundraiser. We have grown to a point where we can now offer thousands and thousands of dollars of scholarships. In fact, this year alone, we reached just about $45,000 worth of scholarships.
That's awesome.
Which is huge for us, and I'm particularly proud of that.
And this gala will help that. Of course, people can get information on your website. We got to wrap this up, but I know you had one more thing you wanted to add, Vicki.
Yes, and at the other end of the spectrum from the adult classes, we have wonderful camps for little kids this summer. We have two camps. One is called Ballet and Art, and the other one is called Cinderella camp. And certainly all this information can be found on our website at www.indieballet.org.
Very good. Ladies, thank you so much for coming in today to Are the Matter. It's great to see you both. Lori, Vicki, have a wonderful From Swans to Splendor spring.
Thank you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Travis DiNicola with Victoria Liris, director of the Indianapolis School of Ballet, and Lori Ecker from ISB. Their spring concert, From Swans to Splendor, takes place at 3 p.m. on Saturday, May 16th and Sunday, May 17th at the Scottish Rite Cathedral. You can get tickets and more information at indieballet.org, indieballet.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The expression, she's a Typhoid Mary, means that someone is a transmitter of something catastrophic, even if that person's appearance gives no hint of danger. Phoenix Theater playwright-in-resident Tom Horan found inspiration in the story of the original Typhoid Mary, an Irish immigrant cook who is believed to have infected dozens of people with typhoid fever, even though she had no symptoms. Sharon Gamble invited Tom to our studios to find out about his new play, which just opened at the Phoenix Theater.
So, how did Typhoid Mary come to you as a subject matter? Were you looking for a sort of protagonist and you just kind of scrolled through history looking for the right person? Or how did this come about?
I'm constantly looking for stories that are historical but that I'm surprised I haven't heard them before.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard the name Typhoid Mary. Who even knows where? It's just those things that feel like in the back of the consciousness. And when I read a short article about who she actually was and became fascinated to know more and dig deeper, read some firsthand documents, that sort of thing.
So for somebody who hasn't maybe seen a PBS documentary about Typhoid Mary, remind us of kind of the time she lived in and what she did for a living and then why she became known by this not all that flattering name.
So this is early 1900s. She was working as a cook. She's an Irish immigrant who came over when she was 14 and had been working in the United States sort of at different people's houses as a personal chef. At this point in history, there is a shift in sort of the authority of what cleanliness is. That Mary is being religious and being Catholic is brought up that there's a religious aspect to being clean. That if you're morally clean, you are clean. But this is the rise of both scientific thinking and the laboratory, that we now have science saying there are things like germs. And while germ theory had been around for maybe 20 years, this makes sense in a scientific community. But if you go to an average person on the street and say that there are invisible things out there that make you sick,
they look at you like you're nuts.
Yeah. So it takes a little while for this sort of thing to make any sense to people. And the reason that Mary, out of everyone, is special is that she was one of the first people that was deemed a healthy carrier.
Ah.
So that means she has no outward signs of being sick. In fact, historically, she said she had never felt that she had typhoid in any way, yet still carried the disease, right? Still had those germs. So the idea that someone would come to her and say, look, I know you've never been sick, but you are getting everyone else sick, you would think they're crazy.
Of course. You would think, especially if you had any reason to think that you were a little different than everybody around you, like you have an Irish accent, and because you've come from another country into this country, you might assume that it's paranoia, prejudice.
You're being persecuted for no reason.
Yeah. Aren't we getting to the era when she's living? Aren't we getting to a time when there's more electric lights are more common and people can see more dirt, but you still can't see germs?
Right.
So what was typhoid fever like?
It's hard for me to even have a contemporary context for it because we're used to people getting sick and then going to the hospital and being treated. But so many of these people would end up staying in the house and being treated, and the idea that this sickness would last for like a month at a time.
Mm.
And some people would get better, but a number of people would die from it and would be accompanied by stomach pains and sweats and fevers and hallucinations and just sort of what we picture as awful sickness. Everything sort of comes along with that.
And you can probably carry it even before symptoms are I mean, you can carry it and have no symptoms, as
Mary did.
But you can probably carry it before symptoms and infect somebody else before the symptoms are apparent in you. So, did people respond? Did people panic
When they heard about Mary? In fact, I think they used Mary as this boogeyman, as here is what is causing this outbreak of typhoid, and saying, we've got her. We've got her in control. She is safe. We don't need to worry as much as long as you take care of yourself. In fact, she was not the only person they found that was a healthy carrier. She was not even the only cook that they found. But she was the only one who was quarantined for that amount of time. And she was the only one who was an immigrant and a woman and poor. And those things contributed to it. And when she went before judges, often you would have men who would say, I'm the breadwinner for this family. You can't quarantine me away. She not only couldn't say that, she was often known for her temper. And because she wasn't nice in front of these judges, they were even more willing to put her away.
Wow. How was she identified as a symptomless carrier in the first place? How did people know to even look at her as a potential reason that people around her were getting sick?
There was a man named Dr. George Soper, and he was interested in this theory about healthy carriers. And he heard about an outbreak that happened in a rich house in Oyster Bay, which was not known for it. Normally it was the poorer houses where there was an outbreak. And they tested everything in the house, and they couldn't find it coming from the regular sources, like tainted water supply. And so he was like, maybe it's one of the people. And so he started testing all the members of the household and found Mary.
Wow. How do we know, obviously, as anytime you're writing a script for something, a play or screenplay, there's a certain amount of speculation. There's a certain amount of kind of, well, what would a person say in these circumstances? But did Mary keep a diary? Do we know a lot? How did you sleuth this out? A lot of research in newspaper archives, or where? How did you find your source material, and how did you figure out her emotional center?
So there's a number of sources. There's some great books on it. Anthony Bourdain wrote a book about her from like the cook perspective that was useful. So I found sources from a number of different places. There's a great Radiolab piece about her. At some point, I think the role of art is to use your imagination, is to get in there. There's a wonderful quote that I'm going to poorly paraphrase by Theodore Roosevelt, who was talking about the importance of literature taking on history, and that is to put flesh on dry bones. That is to embody these people, to make these things not at a distance from us, not a museum piece. And that's what's so wonderful. And some of the great work that's being done by the actors right now in preparation for the production is, what does it mean to embody not just characters, but characters that come from real life people? And there's an empathy that comes along with that I think is possible in art. And the actors, whatever the craft of acting is really coming alive, and seeing them dig into these characters is lovely.
So you've had this, it's not a luxury, it's a necessity for a playwright, but not every playwright gets to have a residency and work with some of the same actors, directors, designers, producers over again. You've had this script read different places. What are you learning new about it that the world of the personnel around the Phoenix Theater might be bringing to light?
They've taught me things about the specificity of the characters. They're teaching me the things that you can't put into words. The things that you can feel the character, you can see the character, find out where their heart is.
Talk to me about what you've learned being in rehearsals related to, do you ever have moments where you go home and get ready to go to bed and go, okay, I really have to rewrite that. I really have to change that.
It happens to me in the middle of the rehearsal room where I'm like, oh, that just needs to be a little bit different. There's a craft of storytelling. And it's often things that I'm like, I don't need that. We can just push on. The audience is smart enough to follow along. How can we keep this story moving forward?
Mm.
And then what are the moments that we need to pause and dive deeper into?
Mm-hmm.
And the actors are really good at finding that and helping me see that. Here's a part where this is a pivotal moment for Mary in her story and for us as an audience members to lean into that and wonder what it was like to be Mary, what it was like to be faced with those choices, where we see Dr. George Soper contemplating what it meant to put someone away. He was also joined by Dr. Sarah Josephine Baker, a female doctor at the time, which was rare, and seeing the two of them deal with the weight of what it means to quarantine someone.
Sure.
And how there's not easy choices. They're deciding between an individual's rights and the well-being of the public at large.
Mary didn't really she was single?
She has actually sort of a complicated home life. She was technically single, but was often seen with a man who she lived with for many years.
So kind of a common law husband.
Yeah.
But still, the fact that she worked tells us that she needed the income.
Yes.
And I suppose one lens you could look through it might be, well, she's being put away. She's essentially quarantined, so the government is taking care of her.
Mm-hmm.
But you're separating her from her independence. And I have the sense that if she was outspoken enough to not be kind to the people making this decision, that she continued being outspoken.
Yes. And in her entire time that she was quarantined, she was writing letters to get released. In fact, she was quarantined twice. She was quarantined for a period of about 3 years, wrote enough letters, and a judge who was essentially like, it seems to me like you should be healthy by now, because even the judges didn't quite understand what it meant to be a healthy carrier. So then she was freed for a period of years, and then because of another outbreak, was quarantined again for the rest of her life.
So she really did become kind of a lightning rod
mm-hmm.
for everything.
Yes, and that's why in the newspapers you see, that's why she was deemed Typhoid Mary, was to put a face to this horrible thing that people are trying to deal with.
And it's something we do, whether it's with disease or warfare.
Mm-hmm.
We do that over and over again. How do you make yourself as a playwright stay in Mary's world and not say, I'm commenting on people who are HIV positive but symptomless. I am commenting on people who practice a different religion and therefore look different when you see them on the street or whatever. How mm-hmm. do you make yourself stay in that moment?
For me, it's trying to imagine how Mary would react in that situation, because I know the audience is going to make those connections.
Yeah.
Every discussion I've had after reading, the audience has been there connecting it to the measles outbreaks or connecting it to Ebola or connecting it to HIV. I feel like those connections are there and that it's important to just stay with her story, stay with what it must have felt like to be her.
Hmm.
Because I think the one thing that we're able to do with art that science and religion both in some ways are not able to is find that empathy. To look at it from her perspective, that we still need to make these hard decisions. Should we value her rights over the good of the public? And whatever we decide, I think we need to approach both sides with empathy, how difficult it is to make the decisions and how difficult it is to be Mary and live with that complicated thing that you don't understand.
We're about halfway through your rehearsal process as we're having this conversation, but I'm curious, do you have a favorite moment of this production of this play?
Well, without giving too much away,
sure.
I was very fascinated by the strange and outsized feeling that she must have felt and the paranoia. So there's some surreal touches to it that without giving anything away, that are really hitting me in a nice way. What she would have imagined the judges were discussing when she was not around, that sort of thing.
Sharon Gamble with playwright Tom Horan. You can see the Phoenix Theater's production of Typhoid Mary through May 24th and learn more at phoenixtheater.org.
Oh, Mom. Calling all moms.
listen to this calendar, because if your adult kids are saying, I just don't know what to get you, I can't possibly get you another bottle of perfume, you might hear something on our calendar that you can suggest to your kids to take you to.
That sounds like a lovely idea.
And here's our calendar that we call
What'll We Do for Mother's Day Weekend? Mother's Day Edition.
That's
there you go.
That's right. Indeed.
Well, I think something that would be lovely to go to, I always love going to ballet, of course, and the Ballet Theater of Carmel is doing Sleeping Beauty. They have had a venue change for this. This is important. Their 2015 spring production, their venue change due to some unfortunate events at the Westfield High School, will now be housed at the Frederick M. Ayers Auditorium at Park Tudor on 71st and College.
That's a fun venue.
Yes, that's a very good venue for them. And the dates and the times remain the same, 2 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, May 9th. And that will be great because they've got a special guest from the Joffrey Ballet as Prince Desire. And that will be very, very cool. So that is coming up this weekend. Again, the Ballet Theater of Carmel will actually not be in Carmel because they'll be at Park Tudor, which is opening their arms to them. And they will be performing Sleeping Beauty this weekend on the 9th, again at 2 and 7:30 p.m.
Fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. Hey, sneak into your mom's room, open her closet door, and if she has any of the following items of clothing, pay close attention. If she happens to have something like a macrame vest, if she has Birkenstock sandals, if she has flare leg jeans, maybe some tie-dye. Okay, I'm going a little overboard with the stereotype because lots of different people like folk music, but that's kind of a sure sign that she would love to be taken to the Indie Folk Series concert this Saturday evening.
Mm, what a great idea.
I know, and it's actually a high-energy bluegrass ensemble. It's Billy Strings and Don Julin. They are known for haunting Appalachian ballads, gospel standards, and high-octane blazing bluegrass instrumentals. I can't make this stuff up. All delivered with a pedal-to-the-metal intensity of a moonshine runner. Just got a lot more interesting,
that
didn't it?
These
performances are at UUI at 615 West 43rd Street, kind of in the shadow of Butler University. Doors open at 615. The concert's at 7. It is a family-friendly affair, so you can bring the grandkids. You can purchase beverages and there are snacks. And it's a very comfortable, easygoing environment for the last concert of the Indie Folk Series season. That's
very
this
good.
Saturday night.
You know, one time I was at a very high-energy folk concert, and I said to the guys, I said, you guys rock. And they said, no, we folk. Well, if your mom folks, then listen to what Sharon just said. But if your mom rocks, you might want to check out getting some tickets for concerts at the Lawn downtown, because they've just announced their schedule, 19 shows that are taking place this summer at the Farm Bureau Insurance Lawn at White River State Park. The first show is only a month away with Third Eyed Blind. Also, Alabama Shakes is coming here June 2nd. I'm not going to go through the whole schedule because it is huge. But Rob Zombie is coming in June, as well as Bare Naked Ladies. We've got Flogging Molly coming in June, and then some really, really fun shows later throughout the year as well. Old Crow Medicine Show, August 2nd. Beach Boys and the Temptations, August 5th. And these are all big outdoor shows, which will be a lot of fun and worth checking out as well. So you can get the whole schedule when you check out the Lawn downtown at White River State Park and see what's going on there. Maybe get some tickets for your mom.
At the concert venue at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on July 4th, Chris, you're going to have to give your mom an IOU for this.
You must really like mom for this one.
The Rolling Stones tickets still available, I'm told.
Ooh, good to know.
Start me up.
Very cool. Hey, the Carmel Theater Company, in partnership with the Carmel Clay Historical Society, is presenting Look Back in History. It's a series of one-person shows based on the lives of six different historical figures. The shows opened in April, and it continues through this weekend, May 9th, at the Intimate Studio 15, located across the street from Woody's Library Restaurant in Carmel. Performances Friday and Saturday. Saturday they will be at 7 p.m. There's also a Sunday matinee as well. And the show coming up this weekend, one on James Whitcomb Riley and the Marquis de Lafayette on Friday, and then Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Edison on Saturday. Sunday this weekend, sorry. But it should be a lot of fun. Historical performances that the Carmel Theater Company is doing this weekend.
So we've offered some performance-based things for you to do with your mom. If your mom likes visual art, listen to this event. Impressionist artists Corinne Hull, Sadie Davis, and Tamara Adams will be featured in this month's show, Impressionism and Color, at the Hoosier Salon Gallery. That's their new home in Carmel, Indiana, which is at 22 North Rangeline Road, kind of around the corner from Mud Bugs, if that places it for you, and a little up the street from the Design Center. There's a reception this Saturday, May 9th, from 5 to 9. It's part of the Second Saturday Art Walk in Carmel, so take advantage and just take a stroll through the town of Carmel with your mom. And I see, notice I'm not suggesting that you need to buy her a painting, but I'll just let that thought dangle out there. That's this Saturday evening at the Hoosier Salon Gallery, Impressionism and Color.
A show that your mom might like as well is an exhibit at the 924 Gallery. That's Gallery 924 that the Arts Council has at 924 Pennsylvania Street. Just opened last weekend. New works by Lois Maine Templeton. Delightful, lovely lady. The show is called It's the Way They Mingle. And Lois will be on Art of the Matter later this month talking about her work and what it's like to be an 86 and a half, as she stated, year old lady who is still painting a ton of beautiful paintings each and every day. Sharon, we got to wrap things up here.
Okay. Ronan Chamber Ensemble this coming Tuesday at 7:30. Mozart and the Wolves of Parnassus. That's all I have time to say.
That's good stuff.
I know.
Well, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us next weekend on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Gallery 42 in downtown Indianapolis is presenting Dialed In for the month of May, an exhibit featuring work by Indianapolis-based automotive artist Gary Dosh. Travis DiNicola spoke with Dosh and gallery director Kurt Hunter about the show.
Gary, Kurt, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
Hey, thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Kurt, let's start with you. I know you and your brother have opened up Gallery 42. What's it been now, a little over a year?
It has been actually about 7 months
that we've been open.
So we opened in September, and so we're at about 7 month mark right now. So things have been really good so far.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, it's always great to have another gallery in Indianapolis, especially one right downtown on East Washington, like pretty much right across from Circle Center and in that block there. It's a great place for a gallery.
Yeah, it's been a great location for us. And, you know, really the fact that the weather's warming up and we're getting a lot more traffic coming through. And so it's been really good. We have some events that we're going to be hosting coming up this summer. And it's been a good family venture thus far. So
very cool. It's a beautiful space. I mean, you have a stunning interior that you have. I mean, there's a great entrance and beautiful space, but also great artwork. Briefly, sort of tell me about your approach as far as what type of art you're carrying and what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, we actually have two different galleries in the space. Mm-hmm. The first floor is a bit more classically inspired artwork. Mm-hmm. So you're going to find primarily living artists that are inspired by the classical vein, which is Renaissance-style artwork and things of that nature. And then second floor at Gallery 42 is a bit more contemporary.
Yeah.
We've got more sports, music, and entertainment-themed artwork upstairs. So what we're trying to do is to really blend kind of two different worlds within the same space. So you're going to find, again, the classical stuff downstairs, a bit more contemporary upstairs. So
Sure. But really all contemporary artists just doing, you know, two different styles there.
Right.
Yeah. And it's, as I said, it's definitely just a beautiful space and some really interesting work that you've got there and have shown there and worth checking, worth stopping by. I know I was really excited when I was down there a little while ago, and it was the first time that I saw one of your works, Gary, that was on the wall. I'm like, oh, this is cool. And then I found out that there was going to be a whole show in May, which is, of course, the perfect time of year to have an art exhibit that's dealing with motorsports, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't get better than that. So, Gary, your work is stunning, I thought. Large scale, very realistic of motorsports, of cars, very colorful, really interesting stuff, and I can't wait to see the whole show. I want to learn a little bit more about you, though, and how you got involved with this. I know you studied as an art teacher, right? Art education.
Yes, I did.
And then got involved in motorsports and cars. And tell me a little bit more about this.
Yeah, well, actually, I think that the car part started when I was about 9 years old. And I was going through a storybook with my grandmother. And we turned the page, and she looks at this picture, and she says, "Oh, that's Uncle Cannonball." And it turns out that the picture was of a vehicle that was being driven by Cannonball Baker, who mm-hmm. was a very famous local personality. And that sort of set the light off, and we took off from there. So I started learning about
Cannonball.
And he
Cannonball. Was your uncle?
He was my great-uncle.
Your great-uncle.
He was actually married to – he was my uncle's uncle, married to – well, grandma's sister.
Just being able to say you have an Uncle Cannonball is kind of cool.
Yeah. So he's been a great inspiration. It set me off on this track about cars and automotive, and mm-hmm. it grew, and the inquisitiveness about how things worked. And at some point I started wondering about, well, why do they have these names on the cars, and how does all that work, and who designs them and paints them and does all that?
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I knew I had to have a real career path, and so I went through the school with education and mm-hmm. art, and did my grad work at Ball State. And then when I got out, I did teach for a little while, and then I went to the corporate world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked in that area, building departments, things to grow advertising and media, and spent about 13 years there. But then I started working my way back, and this with the automotive things continually going on the side, building my own cars, competing myself.
Okay.
So I got my hands on the nuts and bolts of it.
So you were actually, racing, doing that.
Yeah.
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 So that was part of your life as well.
I've gone through a number of cars over the years. And somewhere along the line, Derek Walker popped up, and I took a chance with, just sending him a note. He was in Pennsylvania looking for a marketing person.
Mm-hmm.
And everything seemed to fit, with the corporate world and the automotive world and the graphic design. And I said, they need somebody like this in motorsports. And I knew they were doing it in Europe in Formula One. Well, lo and behold, I get this phone call back from Derek, and he wants to talk to me. And what I find out is, rather than me going to Pennsylvania, he's moving to Indianapolis. So we got together, and we spent 13 years together with me doing that kind of support work within the team.
So you were helping out with which aspects of the corporate sponsorship? Actually painting the cars?
I was actually more in the office side of it.
Okay.
So what I was doing was helping develop the corporate sponsorship type side of it, bringing different kinds of players together, identifying them, figuring out how they were going to work as a marketing program.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And the typical ones that would work in the industry were like bringing Valvoline and Cummins together.
Mm-hmm.
And Valvoline made oil. Cummins needed oil. Valvoline needed diesel engines. Cummins made diesel engines. And that was a huge, huge successful marketing program for Derek.
Okay.
Derek actually was the one who created that concept and pulled it together. But it was good for us for a number of years. And we looked at different ways to take those marketing concepts into the world. We even went as far as – the last ones I did was Team Australia. We decided that, as expensive as motorsports was, that to take it beyond a company-to-company, business-to-business type relationship, we needed to look for something larger. So – I said, let's go get a country. And so we did several proposals with China and England and Canada. And the Australians were the ones that it hit. And it was magic because they had product they wanted to bring to the United States and do things. And it was a really, really successful program that we launched.
You know the business and the sport inside and out.
Yeah.
But at what time then did you say, I want to actually start – making paintings of cars.
Yeah, that happened probably about 10 years into it. Well, I was actually doing all the drawings and things for all the proposals and designing what the cars look like, what the trucks look like, what the uniforms look like.
So it was part of your marketing
work. That was part of my whole marketing deal.
Got it.
So when we go back to the sponsors,
yeah.
we would have all these, you know, layouts, concept drawings, layouts,
sure.
like an ad agency would do, essentially,
of course, yeah.
in pitching
yeah.
a client. And so, but then I got to also the fun part of laying out the paint jobs on the race cars and all mm-hmm. that, you know, as well. And after about 10 years of doing that, I thought, you know, I'd like to some way start to commemorate that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started going back to my fine art training, and I started to paint again. And so I did the one painting, and the guys all of a sudden said, oh, that's really cool. I want one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I started doing limited edition prints, you know, for the crew and so on.
Sure.
And then it's grown and grown, and I've enjoyed it immensely because I'm using things that, you know, I was blessed to have a talent, I guess, towards,
mm-hmm.
and that's how it's all oozing out of me, if you will.
No, that's awesome. Yeah. But that makes the perfect sense in mm-hmm. terms of how that progressed and evolved and the pains that you see. I mean, one of the first things that really struck me is, you know, and I didn't know a lot about your background when I first saw mm-hmm. the paintings, but I thought this guy must know the sport extremely well and yeah. must know the cars because the detail that's in it and the real sense of speed as well as just the clarity of the cars really comes through.
And that's – I've tried to kind of – bring a whole bunch of different things together and they sort of clash into this in that I've touched the nuts and bolts because I built the cars myself on,
yeah.
in my own world of it. And I've tried to, you know, keep up with the technology as things were moving. So I knew what was there and I knew what it looked like and I knew what it did.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, you've got, you know, the composition and the design and the layout of the piece itself. And then I also do things like I tend to push the colors a bit to
yeah.
try to make them more vibrant and
they're very
a little
bold.
More excitement, yeah, into them. But I try to also keep a balance between the detail
mm-hmm.
and the motion and the activity.
There's also a lot of detail of the track itself,
yeah.
which you don't always see in some motorsport art.
Gravel,
the gravel, the curbs, I mean, that part really comes through as well mm-hmm. and becomes part of the composition.
Yeah. yeah. And it takes me a long time to do these.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger ones can run up in the 200-hour range you know, to do them. But, you know, I love doing it. It's very passionate for me to do that, go sit at the easel for hours and
mm-hmm.
and pull these things out.
Kurt, I want to turn back to you a bit. So how did Gallery 42 find Gary here and decide to want to do the show?
Well, actually, the way that it started was, and Gary, maybe you can jump in, because he actually just came in through the doors and
yeah.
Had heard of our gallery. I'm not sure, again, how you had heard of us, correct?
Yeah, some of the local suppliers here in town that you had been meeting
That's what it was,
and
yeah.
talking to, and a name had popped up there, and I kept looking for something. You know, finally, I didn't see it, so I just tracked him down,
cool.
knocked
yeah,
on the
so,
door.
So he came in, and
nice.
We had an opportunity to sit down and chat for a while. And I was able to see some of his work and just thought it was great.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And
that's always a nice experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the other thing that was really nice was that we were looking for kind of a local artist and
mm-hmm.
to have more of the local flavor in our
yeah.
gallery because – you know, primarily what we have is kind of national and international artists that we show in the space. So we
sure.
really wanted to have, you know, kind of a local artist come in. And so when Gary came in, we had an opportunity. We had a good conversation, and he invited Nick, my brother, and I down to his studio to really see some of his work. And you know, we both really thought it would be a great fit for what we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of just went from there and
That's
we're able
cool.
to work it out. And now we're getting ready to have his show coming up.
That month. Had to be a pretty cool moment when you open up the portfolio or walked into his studio and saw the work and like, oh, yeah, this stuff's pretty amazing.
Yeah, because a lot of times and is what you get is you get artists that come in and of course, they, you know, they want to show you their work and they want to be represented and shown in the gallery. And unfortunately, we can't. Do that with every artist that comes through the doors. So we're pretty selective
yeah, of
who
course.
We like to work with, and so. But we were really impressed with Gary and his work. So it's been good so far.
Nice, that's great.
Yeah. One of the things I'm trying to do with the pieces is
mm-hmm.
to raise them into that automotive fine art.
Yes,
I think is the way to define it. And I had an experience with one of the drivers who was actually presented one of the paintings that I did of his car as a gift by someone, and it was at a big party, and his wife was there, and her comment was, gee, I really like that. It's the only piece of racing stuff I'm going to allow in the house. So I felt that, you know, I was on the right track mm-hmm. once I got that kind of an approval. So.
Well, I would agree. I mean, I like a lot of motorsport art, but a lot of it is you know, sometimes the perspective is off or whatever it may be, or it's cool from a fan standpoint, but maybe not a great piece of art in terms of composition and color and style. And yours really seems to transcend that.
I'm trying to keep out of the poster realm.
Yeah, exactly.
Know, I think that's
and that's what I want
to
be really
it.
Clear yeah, about. Yeah. Yeah. Because they're gorgeous paintings that happen to also be of cars, which is very cool.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I wanted to mention that we're trying to do with Second Floor at Gallery 42 is to take the subject matter of sports, music, and entertainment, in this case, you know, the race industry, and kind of elevate it to the realm of fine art to where just because the subject matter is what it is doesn't mean that it can't be fine art.
Exactly.
And so that's what we're attempting to do with the Second Floor, and that's why we felt like his work does that and was a good fit for us. So.
Awesome. Well, I encourage people to come check it out. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure chatting with you both. Gary, Kurt, thanks so much for coming into Art of the Matter today.
All right.
Thanks for having us.
Travis DiNicola with artist Gary Dosh and Gallery 42 director Kurt Hunter. Dosh's show, Dialed In, runs through May 23rd at the gallery located on Washington Street in downtown Indianapolis. Dialed In will close with a public open house on Friday, May 22nd from 6 to 9 p.m. And more information is available at gallery42.com. You're going to spell out the words 40 and 2, so gallery42.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. I'll take a stroll with the Indianapolis Garden Walk.
Well, we will also air the complete interview I did with musician Stuart Copeland, formerly of The Police, from when he was in town last month.
And I'll talk with Kirk Trevor about his nearly three-decade-long career with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. Plus, there'll be that calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.